is VK6ARN, News West. We are a community organisation and we've been serving up the best amateur radio news in Australia since 1931. Hi there, I'm Clinton, VK6FCRC, and welcome to News West for the 17th of March, 2024. Now on the show.
Hi, just a little note about VK6RRG and the WAG Technical and General Net. Having it run every Sunday morning on VK6RLM, that's 146.750, or Channel 3 in the old money. And it starts at 10:30 a.m. this morning. Of course, if you're listening in the evening, it's next week.
Good morning, campers. The month of May is not far away, and that means it's time to mark on the calendar the third annual Southern Electronics Group Man Up Ham Camping Weekend of the May 17th to 19th. If you haven't been before, Ham Camping is a casual weekend getaway for hams and other registered HF users like AusTravelNet and VKS737 and their significant others to drag the swag, the van or the tent down to Man Up Sports Ground for a weekend of radio and social activity. There's plenty of room to camp. There's some big trees to throw a line over, hot showers, a camp kitchen, terrific fire pit to sit around after dark, and of course, time to sit and chat over the weekend with like-minded radio enthusiasts. Food and drinking water is BYO. The kitchen and amenities are powered, but there's no power available for campsites. It's been known to rain, fog, and then bright sunshine, often on the same day, so you need to come prepared. Camping is the usual low price of $10 per person per night. There'll be a Square card reader on the weekend available and SEG can take online payments. Boyer Brook has a great car museum and other attractions if you want to visit town 15 minutes away while you're here. We maintain a Ham Camption Facebook page for up-to-date information and you can contact me at VK6EK, that's Victor Kilo Sierra India X-Ray Echo Kilo at gmail.com. We hope to see you there. This is Darren, VK6EK, for the Southern Electronics Group.
Hi, I'm Steve, VK6SJ, with another episode of Did You Know? This week I thought I might talk about my thoughts on operation at higher output power than our current 400 watt allowance. ACMA have committed to considering our maximum power limit later this year, and many of us are hoping that we'll finally be able to run our amps harder than we have in the past, or in some cases, without fear of being found to be operating outside our license conditions. What will they consider? 20 years ago, the trusty old Yaesu workhorse FL2100 series of amplifiers will do around 700 watts, so running them at 400 kept them well within their specs and not pushing them too hard. This amplifier was staple diet for many HF aficionados, including even quite a few CB operators on 11 metres. These days, there actually aren't a lot of valve amps on the new purchase market. It's cheaper and more efficient to use an LDMOS transistor power amplifier. It can easily do 1 to 2 kilowatts with only 50 or 60 watts input. Most transistor-based amplifiers will do a kilowatt minimum, and I'm guessing it is very tempting to wind that wick up a little bit more and let the amp have its way. Why would it be useful to have at least 1 kilowatt privileges? It is true that you don't need a kilowatt to work the world. As a novice, I had a bag of fun on 10 meter converted CB, loaned to me by Mark, 6 Whiskey Victor, running 20 watts into a homebrew 5-element Yagi, but this was in the middle of Sunspot 22 in the mid to late 70s, which was one of the biggest Sunspot cycles in living history. Working Europe in the troughs of the last cycle would have been somewhat less fun. I guess the main reason I see for using a kilowatt or more is that we're actually at the end of the populated world, so when chasing that new rare DX entity and competing against most of the rest of the world, who are allowed from 1 to 1.5 kilowatts, we are at a bit of a disadvantage. Also, there is also that joy of just having an armchair natter with someone on the opposite side of the globe with a bit more power facilitates. To put this in perspective, the difference between 100 watts and 1,000 watts is 10 dB. This means that someone running a kilowatt into a dipole will have a similar EIRP to someone with a 5-element Yagi, but using just 100 watts. That's a lot of effort to go to and far more expensive to achieve than using an amplifier. So, why are we almost alone in the world and limited to just 400 watts? Well, when you look at the standards that the ACMA holds all citizens to in terms of safety, it's actually hard to argue against their stance. None of us want to harm anyone with our hobby, and using a kilowatt from your car, for instance, could potentially harm a bystander if he or she happened to be too close to an antenna. I remember while serving in the Australian Navy, one of our favourite stunts was to sit next to someone sitting next to a HF whip at sea inside the yellow circle with a fluorescent tube in hand, lit up only by the 1 kilowatt RTTY transmission from the antenna, and then ask that person if he understood what was energising the fluorescent tube. Normally only I had to do that one once. Around 10 years ago, the ACMA did conduct a trial on 1 kilowatt operation. Many operators applied for the privilege. A part of that privilege was a requirement to analyse our stations to ensure that they were safe. A spreadsheet was produced that made this analysis easy to do, and all that was asked was that participants in the trial help proof of that analysis. If you have a doctorate in maths, you could carry out the analysis manually, or if you were like me and most others, you would just use the spreadsheet and then print off a copy in case you received a knock on the door from your friendly radio inspector. Unfortunately, when the ACMA did actually conduct an audit on participants, many had not carried out that simple analysis, and the trial was called off, and we were once more back to only using 400 watts. It is actually possible to gain a 1 kilowatt license, just not on the amateur bands. There are a few commercial HF sites with licenses to use a kilowatt. Examples include sites used to communicate with aircraft. Then, of course, most broadcast sites use much higher than 1 kilowatt. In fact, the only broadcasters using just a kilowatt are generally community radio stations. A part of the process to gain these allocations is a requirement to prove adherence to the ARPANSA requirements that dictate how the safety of the site is managed. In addition, there are many commercial sites that have anything up to 10 or 15 50-watt transmitters sharing a single antenna. The combined output of these systems are not dissimilar to what many hams aspire to. So, what will be different this time around? How do we convince the ACMA that we can be responsible enough to manage a higher powered station? One of the things we could do right now to prove our responsibility is to actually carry out those calculations for our own stations now, based not just on the 400 watts we need, but at the highest power output that the station is capable of. Actually, if you do run 400 watts or anything above 100 watts, you are required by law to do the same process that was expected of us during the trial. Maybe we need one or two repositories where we can place those analyses that ACMA could access and see how serious we now take this responsibility, rather than a bulk email to them separately, which would quickly end up in a spam folder. This wouldn't be a declaration of the use of higher power, just an analysis of what the station is capable of and could be used lawfully in an emergency situation. There are some other latent advantages of operating a station at 1 kilowatt or more. With a station operating at that kind of power, everything has to be spot on. My first use of an amplifier resulted in a melted trap caused by a 2-to-1 VSWR that I used to just use my inbuilt ATU on the radio to fix. But with 700 watts and a high VSWR, it ended up exceeding significantly the rated capacity of the trap. Had another similar experience where I accidentally tuned an amp into a 15-metre antenna whilst being on 10 metres and shorted out an adapter we were using to join two coax lines. It was a lighthouse weekend portable station. One of the things I suspect ACMA will be looking at is the audit requirements they may inherit as a result of giving us these privileges. We could reduce that risk by voluntarily providing evidence. Whilst I'm definitely an advocate of having access to the use of higher power, I do also want to see it done responsibly, even if many other countries do not carry out this due diligence. Ever since the hobby began, the amateur community has maintained a stance of self-policing. I remember being nudged when I accidentally called CQ above 28.6 megs when I was still a novice licensee. It wasn't a beating, just a comment. Better check your dial, young fella. Our operating procedures are largely self-imposed, as are our band plans. Whilst our operating power outputs are not something habitually policed, and couldn't be if we were to be honest, having that simple proof of the safeness of our stations is something that we could all support each other in, even now, whilst we still only have a 400-watt limit. All right, off my soapbox. Thanks for listening. This is Steve, AK6SJ.
This is News West, your amateur radio news on VK6ARN, originating on the News West Linked Repeater Network and HF Relays.
If you happen to listen to the right part of the 80-metre band on a Tuesday evening, you might hear something that sounds like this. The CQQRS net has been running every single Tuesday for the last 2 years and has been unbelievably popular. There are usually half a dozen, and a couple of times up to 18 stations, popping in and out, when they can, over the 4 or 5 hours. The aim is to encourage new CW operators to have a go at slow CW in a safe and really friendly environment, where slow speed and lots of mistakes are par for the course. It's all about having a go, starting with a basic call sign and RST exchange, then, over time, getting better and better. The net also attracts its fair share of old-timers who enjoy helping others to have a go or just to enjoy the banter. So this might be just the opportunity you've been waiting for to have a go at transmitting on CW, or perhaps just to stop the contacts rusting up on your key. Doesn't matter whether you're brand new to the code or if you're an old-timer who would like to have a bit of fun and help encourage new operators by having simple, safe QSOs at their speed, we'd love to have you join in. The net starts at 0900 Zulu every Tuesday on 80 metres between 3540 and 3570 kHz, and there's stations in the west, east and in between listening out for your CQQRS call. For more information and to receive our weekly CQQRS RagChew newsletter, contact me, Mark, VK6QI, via my email address on qrz.com, or you can email me direct, mark.bosma@icloud.com, that is mark.bosma@icloud.com. Too much switch mode power supply hash on 80 metres? This might be the incentive to do something about it. With a cheap noise canceller costing less than $100, 80 metres could be easier than you think. So once again, Tuesdays from 0900 Zulu until late, between 3540 kHz and 3570 kHz. Cheers from Mark, VK2KI and VK6QI.
Foundations of Amateur Radio. So, the 19th of February 2024 came and went. As it was, my day started with the highest minimum that month, 27.5 degrees Celsius. That's the minimum overnight temperature. The maximum that day here in Perth, Western Australia, was 42.3 degrees. The day before was the highest maximum for the month, 42.9. If you're not sure, that's over 109 in Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit scale. That same day, the Australian regulator, the ACMA, launched a new era in amateur radio. Moving from personal amateur licenses, we legally became part of a class license regime. We had the option to hand our license back and get a refund, but the cautious side of me prevailed and I've not yet handed back my license, since it's currently the only proof that my call sign is valid, the one issued to me in December 2010. I contacted the ACMA to ask about this and was told that they were having display issues with their system and was sent an image showing both my call signs and email address. I'm not saying that I don't trust the person sending this to me, but I'm fairly sure that, "But, Your Honour, it was in an email," isn't going to cut it if push comes to shove. Curiously, my name appears to be missing, showing the word blank instead. Their IT team has been working on displaying F calls for weeks now. I mean, seriously, these were first issued in 2005. Do we really need to spell this out? The ACMA continues to actively encourage amateurs to hand in their license and points out that any delay in doing so will reduce the amount that may be due. It also points at Schedule 4, Part 2, Subclause 7.1d of the Radio Communications Amateur Stations Class License 2023 to assure me that my call sign is mine and mine alone, irrespective of what's in the register. It goes on to say that the letter they sent back in January, the one they had to resend since they got my call sign details wrong, explains that I could hand back my license and that my ability to operate hinged on my qualification, not my call sign. Here's the rub. Let's say that I'm qualified and that the letter I have proves it. I'm required to identify myself on air. The regulations say so. This means that in order for me to claim that I am who I say I am, there needs to be a register with that call sign. Apparently, I'm in the register, but nobody other than the regulator can prove that. One thing that appears to be missing is a solid understanding that the register of call signs is used by the amateur community to determine if a call sign heard on air is assigned or not. I mean, I could call myself Victor Kilo 6 Echo Echo November, and without the register, who's to say that it's mine? It's not confidence-inspiring, to say the least. Then there's the register itself. There's an online component, which you can use to search for a call sign. As I said, mine isn't visible. Neither is any other four-letter F call. As a test, I've been scrolling, one page at a time, for the past hour to get to VK6F, starting at VK6A, to see if it shows up. But I'm not holding my breath. For some reason, the developers who built this appear incapable of rendering a simple table in anything less than 36 seconds per page, so much so that Chrome thinks that the page is crashed and offers to kill it every time. Funnily enough, if you extract the URL from within the page and copy it, you can download all 176 pages for VK6 call signs in less time than it took me to write this sentence. Unsurprisingly, F calls are not there. Did I mention that this software, released a month ago, is already using depreciated features in my current web browser, which came out a week before the new register went live? It gets better. If you actually want to manage your call sign, you need to create an account on the regulator's portal called ACMA Assist. When you load the ACMA Assist URL and click the Sign Up or Login button, 134 different URLs from all over the internet are hit across 34 different domains, including Facebook, Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn, Mark Monitor, Monsedo, several content, font, icon, and JavaScript libraries, and plenty more. This is a government website requiring that I authenticate to it, and to do that, I'm required to provide more identity documents than the tax department needs, and, wait for it, authentication is outsourced to some random domain. So you're entering your details into a third-party service. You have the choice of using the government identity provider, one that requires a mobile phone and an app, or use a government-owned company that prefers a mobile and a different app, but offers access via a website, on yet another domain. Now it gets funky. If you pick driver's license, you'll discover that everything that's on your license is information that the form wants. So anyone with a photo of your license can sign up and identify as you, like the chemist who required a photocopy of it so you could buy Sudafed for your debilitating hay fever, because instead you might use it to create methamphetamine, or the nightclub that required it so you could enter the venue, because of course they do, or the telecommunications company that provided access to your details during a recent hack. Just so we are clear here, I'm now required to validate my identity to access a call sign that is already in the database, already has my email address linked to it, and is for an amateur license that I already have been in possession of and paid for since 2010. Never mind that I used to email the regulator to have them issue an invoice that I paid for via credit card. No authentication at all. And that was for a personal license issued specifically to me. We'll also ignore that if you signed up with ACMA Assist a year ago, you don't need to validate. Not then, not now. Speaking of email, the ACMA has just sent me one, telling me that I can request and fill in a form and email or fax it to them to update my records instead. That's interesting, but what about the privacy implications of tracking by the world's megacorporations on a government site? or even the security theatre for something that, according to the regulator, isn't even my permission to operate. I'm all for giving the regulator the benefit of doubt, but if this is the future of amateur radio licensing in Australia, I'm beginning to wonder just which Wild West Orwellian landscape I stepped into, and I'm asking myself, is this the best that our limited taxpayer dollars can achieve? If you want to see this for yourself, open up your browser, press F12, and have a look at the Network Connection tab while you visit the ACMA Assist portal. Finally, I have one question. Why are our so-called representative bodies, the WIA and RASA, not jumping up and down about this? Apparently, I'm Ono, Victor Kilo 6, Foxtrot Lima Alpha Bravo.
Hi there, it's Clinton, VK6FCRC, back with you. And did you know that NewsWest is now on YouTube? Type in youtube.com/@NewsWest Weekly Podcast -Kilo Zulu 7 Yankee Charlie. Oh, and before I go, I'd like to thank those watching on YouTube or ATV, the readers, and you for listening. I'd also like to thank our team, the broadcasters, and those submitting content each week. Please stand by now for callbacks after the broadcast, or head over to the VK6.net website and fill out the form so we know how many people are listening each week.